dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the War of Ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. A man whose intelligence, among other remarkable qualities, I've come to admire greatly, especially with respect to one of the major challenges we face in our time's phase of this war for the free world, is our guest, I'm very pleased to say, for the full hour today. His name is Dr. Andrew Bostom. He is a medical doctor, a polymath by my lights, who, among many other qualities and skills and accomplishments, is the author of four, conservatively, I think there are more, but four very directly relevant books to our topic today, which is Anti-Semitism and the Manifestations of It That Seem to Be Growing by the Moment in our country as well as elsewhere. And we're going to talk particularly with one of the country's preeminent experts on the subject about one of the most important, if not the most important, wellsprings of anti-Semitism and anti-Zionism, and as he calls it, Jew hatred, namely the tenets of Sharia, that Islamic totalitarian code that we talk a lot about on this program. And I'm very pleased to be able to say we're going to talk about it at some length with Dr. Bostom. Andy, welcome back to Secure Freedom Radio. It's so good to have you with us.
Thank you very much for talking about this topic, Frank.
Well, it's such an important topic, and in fact, it's a focus of effort at the moment at the Center for Security Policy under the leadership of my friend and colleague Fred Flights. And in fact, we did a program on this at CPAC last week, in which the subject was, I think, very helpfully discussed. But I'm pleased to have, with your background and deep knowledge of this subject, the chance to pick your brain at some length. And let me just mention several of the books that really qualify Andy Bostom as an expert on this topic. Legacy of Jihad, written in 2005. The Legacy of Islamic Anti-Semitism, published in 2008. Sharia versus Freedom, The Legacy of Islamic Totalitarianism, published in 2012. And Iran's Final Solution for Israel, The Legacy of Jihad and Shiite Islamic Jew Hatred in Iran, published in 2014. Andy, I don't know when you have time to do anything else, but thank you for taking a few minutes to talk with us today. So let's set the stage. What is the genesis of what you describe, as I said, as Jew hatred in the religious traditions or the political, military, legal doctrine of Sharia in Islam?
Well, unfortunately, it's very, very deeply rooted, hardwired, I would say, into the Quran itself. So, for example, you know, the Quran is relatively short, 114 chapters or surahs, they're called, and the ordering is basically longest to shortest, starting with the second surah through the 114th. But the opening of the surah was sort of spatchcocked on after the fact, and it's called the Fatiha, the opening. It's a very short surah of only seven short verses, and Muslims repeat this 17 times a day during their five prayer sessions and the subdivisions of those prayer sessions. And it ends in a seventh verse that talks about those who've engendered Allah's anger and those who've gone astray. And Muhammad himself, in a canonical hadith, a tradition, clarified that those who incurred Allah's wrath are the Jews and the misguided are the Christians. And why is that? What is it about the Jews in particular that have incurred Allah's wrath? Well, there's a lot of exegesis on this, a lot of Quranic analysis on this, and it goes through a whole litany of the Jews' bad characteristics. It reads almost like an indictment, conviction, and punishment process throughout the Quran. But, you know, and I've analyzed the classical commentators on this, but to bring it up to modern times, I think there's nothing more clarifying than a book that was written and published in 2006. It's a mainstream academic text called The Quran and Encyclopedia. And it's written by Muslims and non-Muslims that are in the academy that all lean left. It's published by Routledge. And here's their very brief description of this verse. They say the phrase in the daily prescribed prayers, guide us to the straight path, to the path of those you have blessed, not those who have incurred your wrath, nor of the misguided, mention two groups of people, but do not say who they are. The prophet interpreted those who incurred God's wrath as the Jews and the misguided as the Christians. The Jews, we are told, killed many of their prophets. Indeed, in the Hadith, it's elaborated that it's a conspiratorial process when it comes to Muhammad. They caused his death by poisoning. The Shiites have traditions that claim that the Jews were further responsible for the death of Ali and his son. So one of the repeated sins is prophet killing. And then through their character and materialistic tendencies have contributed much to moral corruption, social upheaval, and sedition in the world. They were readily misled and incurred both Allah's wrath and ignominy. And so, of course, these are all linked to other important Quranic verses. There are whole lists of negative traits. Being usurious is from the second surah, the 275th verse. Being greedy is the fourth surah, the 161st verse. Being greedy and hedonistic is elaborated in the second surah, the 96th verse. Envious, the second surah, the 109th verse. It's a vast litany, and then throw in apes and pigs and things like that. But they're all supposed to be coupled to this opening, very short, very elusive surah that Muslims repeat 17 times a day. And so it's very frightening when you consider this.
And Andy, would it be your professional judgment? Is there any doubt when they recite these prayers 17 times a day that the faithful Muslims are very clear as to who have earned the wrath of Allah and who have been misguided as well? Is that something that you have to ground around to find deep in a hadith or in the Encyclopedia of Islam or in some other text? Or is that something that is baked in, as I say, and taught to the faithful?
It's taught regularly. However, Frank, I will say that if there are Muslims whose Islam they sit very lightly on and were very, you know, westernized or whatever, just not devout in terms of the tradition and getting the instruction, they may be unaware of it.
Just as they may not practice Sharia or they may not really be following the other tenets of the faith. Andy, we have to pause. And when we come back, I want to drill down a bit further on this because you've used terms like the Quran, which is pretty well known, the Hadiths in particular, that explicate, as you've indicated, some of these texts is another important source, as are some of the early biographies of Muhammad, the perfect man. And we'll conclude, you know, a quick course on this by establishing whether, in fact, it is the duty of the faithful Muslim. Not all Muslims practice this, but it is the duty of the faithful Muslim, according to the authorities of the faith, to hate the Jews. That and more with the author of The Legacy of Islamic Antisemitism, Dr. Andrew Bostom, right after this.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
Welcome back for part two of our very illuminating, very troubling conversation with Dr. Andrew Bostom, an internist, a medical doctor by training, but a man who has devoted much of his life to chronicling, explicating, and otherwise raising an alarm about anti-Semitism and the scourge it represents, not just in some ancient time, but in our own. Andy Bostom, welcome. Let me ask you just to further elaborate on something you touched on before the break, namely the degree to which it's not just in the Quran, in surah after surah after surah, but it's also in the accounts of Muhammad's life and the model that it represents for faithful Muslims Talk about the Hadith, talk about the early biographies and what the takeaway is from them with respect to Jew hatred.
So I gave a very important example, which is where Muhammad explains who the reference, those sort of elusive references are to in those who've engendered Allah's anger and those who've gone astray and those who've engendered Allah's anger are the Jews. But more importantly, there's other parts of the narrative that are clarified. So the idea that the Jews are killers of prophets is continued in the Hadith to literally include Muhammad himself. And in the Sunni and Shiite traditions, it's alleged to have been a poisoning, in some cases a conspiratorial poisoning of Muhammad after the Battle of Khaybar. In the Shiite traditions, that is also extended to include responsibility for the deaths of Ali and Hussein. Then just the all the interactions that are portrayed certainly in the Medinan period are actually quite dark, and Muhammad is very angry and arranges assassinations, etc. And then we'll bring in Quranic verses. So, for example, the infamous verse about the Jews' transformation into apes, which is Quran 265 or Quran 7166, or apes and pigs, which is Quran 560. Muhammad uses those epithets when he's confronting the Jews on two critical occasions, the Banu Qurayza, who he ultimately personally beheads when they're submitted in the Hadith. That's also in there. Muhammad is literally the sword wielder when 700 or so are beheaded. And then he repeats this epithet to the Khaybar Jews after they've been defeated. So those are very powerful examples of how these themes are used in the Hadith and actually also in the Sirah, in the biographies of Muhammad. So when I first brought to light this incredible essay by Georges Vaida, which was an analysis from 1937 of the themes in the Hadith, he just basically said that the Jews are portrayed in very dark colors. It in turn fed into their being humiliated under the Sharia for the characterization that they are given in the Hadith, amplifying in the Quran.
Yeah. Now, let's just pause on this one point, Andy, because it's hard to overstate the importance of these texts and scriptures and, you know, Holy Writ on those who believe that every word is from Allah or otherwise sacrosanct. When the prophet's personal example is that of someone who has not only vilified and otherwise castigated Jews, but murdered hundreds of them himself, it's hard not to believe that there's something in the DNA of this religious practice, political system, Sharia path, and so on, that is rabidly anti-Semitic. And that brings me to sort of the question of the moment. Again, this is not simply a matter of ancient history. This is something that is going on in our time. In fact, in a recent radio interview, I think you called it a global pandemic of Jew hatred, not all of which, to be sure, emanates from Muslims or Sharia supremacists, if you will, but a fair amount of it does. Talk us through, Andy, what we're seeing notably in the Middle East at the moment with respect to both Sunni and Shiite Jew hatred in hostility towards Israel, most especially.
Well, the outcome data, if you want to call it that, are the survey data that the ADL has done.
That's the Anti-Defamation League, of course.
The Anti-Defamation League, yes. And of course, they're if anything, they lean left, in these days maybe even hard left. But they have come up with a scale where they basically listed 11 very, very negative stereotypes of Jews. And on their scale, if you affirmed at least six or more of these stereotypes, you agreed with them, That gave you a degree of anti-Semitism that was extreme, or index, as they called it. And 50% of the world's Muslims harbor this degree of animus. And that's anywhere from 2 to 3-fold any other religious group. So if we compare Muslims as a group, this is global Muslims, to Christians, to Hindus, to Buddhists, or those professing no religion, atheists, It rates anywhere from 2 to 3-fold higher. What's interesting is that when you go to regions, obviously, where you expect more of this kind of Jew hatred, it's 75% of Middle Eastern and North African Muslims agree with at least 6 out of 11 of these stereotypes. Obviously, in Gaza and Judea, Samaria, 92 to 93%. And that's also true of Iraq. Egypt and Saudi Arabia, about 74 to 75%. Unfortunately, Europe, that number is already up to 55%.
Now, Andy, just to clarify, when you say in Europe, you're not talking about just Muslims in Europe. You're talking about the whole population in Europe, 55%?
This is the Muslims. The Muslims of Europe. So there was an oversample of the Muslims so they could actually get stable data. And the Muslims were 55%. And again, Frank, across the board, the non-Muslims are always a rate that's 2 to 3-fold lower. So it's quite striking. And then finally, they were very quiet about this, the ADL, but they did put out a little supplement that I finally picked up. It came out in 2017. I'd missed it. And I saw it recently. And it was the same scale applied to U.S. Muslims. And it was already 34%. Now, you could say, well, it's not 50%. It's not 55% like in Europe. It's not 75% like in the Middle East. But the index, the non-Muslim population of the United States, which is perhaps one of the most certainly more philo-Semitic countries in the world, is only 14%. So it's already 2.4-fold higher in this country, which is, again, perhaps the most philo-Semitic country in the world.
So this is now truly at epidemic levels. And when I say this, we mean a kind of use your term again, Jew hatred, anti-Semitism, anti-Zionism, a practice in some cases that is not confined to simply denunciations or slanderous charges, but actual physical attacks, is it not? And what is the effect of that in places, notably in Europe, on the Jewish population there?
Yeah, I mean, they feel like they're under siege. In Europe, there's a couple of interesting things that were done independent of the ADL. So back in 2008, this was when Franco Frattini was involved in the collection of data on anti-Semitism and racism. He gave an interview where he basically gave away the store, where he said that despite the fact that the Muslim population at that point was only 4 or 5% of the total European population, they were committing, in terms of violent acts, they were committing half of them. So all you have to do, Frank, is say, well, God, that's about 20 to 25 times more likely to commit violence than the rest of the population. If 4% are committing what the other 96% commit, and then in 2015 and 2017, to get at just the attitudinal data, like the ADL type data, European sociologists actually investigated what drove those attitudes. Now, this is not violent acts. These are just the attitudes, like the ADL data I gave you. And in two independent reports, they said, quote, the level of anti-Semitism rises with the level of Islamic religiosity and with so-called fundamentalist interpretations of Islam. Muslim respondents' high level of religiosity was therefore a key factor in explaining the high level of anti-Semitism amongst Muslims. Again, these were analyses that drilled down below just the raw numbers that the ADL provided. They also found similar, numbers to the ADL, but they did something that the ADL did not do, which is try and address the ideology.
And the ideology, to put a fine point on it, would be Sharia. It would be this tradition of translating the literal words of the Quran and of the Hadiths and of Muhammad's life into practice that is supposed to be the path, the comprehensive path for all faithful Muslims, right?
And the Quran. I mean, so if you go back to the pinnacle of religious education, certainly for Sunni Muslims, it would be Al-Azhar University. And the current Grand Imam, Al-Tayyib, made it very plain. He gave an interview in 2013 in October. He said, a verse in the Quran explains the Muslims' relations with the Jews. This is an historical perspective which has not changed to this day. See how we suffer from global Zionism and Judaism, which is interesting. He puts the two, makes the two equivalent. Since the inception of Islam 1,400 years ago, we have been suffering from Jewish and Zionist interference in Muslim affairs. This is a cause of great distress for the Muslims. The Quran said it, and history has proven it. And then he quotes Quran 582, which is sort of a projecting verse, which says that you shall find the strongest among men in enmity to the believers to be the Jews. But it's always used as an excuse, of course, to animate Muslim hatred.
Yeah, yeah. Andy, hold the thought. We have to pause for another moment. When we come back, we're going to translate the phenomena of Jew hatred and Islamist religiosity and fervor in terms of adherence to Sharia into what is happening in America increasingly. We'll do that just on the other side of a short break.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
We're back, joined by Dr. Andrew Boston. I consider him to be a polymath. Anyone listening to the first two segments will have established his extraordinarily deep and impressive knowledge about the Quran, the Hadith, the other spiritual guidance of Islam, and how imbued it is with, well, there's no getting around it, folks, Jew hatred, anti-Semitism, and now in the modern age, anti-Zionism. And Andy, you were talking about Al-Azhar University, and it does have a very important place in the Sunni Muslim world. You've mentioned it's kind of the Vatican, I guess. But talk about Al-Tayyib's predecessor as the leader of Al-Azhar University and his contributions to this authoritative rendering of Islam and its anti-Semitic tendencies.
Sure. His predecessor died of a heart attack in 2010, and he was a grand imam, again, the Sunni Muslim papal equivalent, essentially, at Al-Azhar. His name was Sheikh Mohammed Sayed Tantawi. His lifelong opus work, which really created his ticket to becoming the grand imam, was a book called Jews in the Quran and Traditions. It is a 700-page, very, very dark opus. And I can give you just the kernel of it. He says the Quran describes the Jews with their own particular degenerate characteristics, again, i.e. killing the prophets of Allah, corrupting his words by putting them in the wrong places, consuming the people's wealth frivolously, refusal to distance themselves from the evil they do, and other ugly characteristics caused by their deep-rooted lasciviousness. Only a minority of the Jews keep their word. All Jews are not the same. The good ones become Muslims, and he quotes Quran 3:113, the bad ones do not. I mean, so this is, again, this is for heaven's sake, if Frank, if you know, as a Catholic, I mean, I think you would be appalled if your current Pope or Francis or any of the popes in your lifetime had uttered these kinds of things.
Well, that's for sure, but perhaps we can turn to what the Pope did just recently with this same Grand Imam Al-Tayyib recently. Andy, talk us through that and some of the subtext of what they agreed.
Yeah, I'm honestly not in familiar in detail, but the substance that I gather from it was some sort of agreement on dialogue. Which is, you've gone through this before, Frank. It's Muslim-Christian dialogue is really fraught with dangers. But of course, there's no confrontation. There never is on the part of the Christian authorities in dealing with Islam's bigoted traditions, whether it's against Christianity itself or against Jews or against non-Jewish, non-Christian religions, Hinduism, Buddhism, etc. Or the ideas, the Sharia supremacist ideas of killing apostates and blasphemers, et cetera. None of that is ever confronted, and this was yet another occasion for that.
Yeah, and that's what's so troubling about it, is that it perpetuates this false narrative of interfaith dialogue, that somehow there is a mutuality of respect and tolerance and whether it's with just Christians and in this case the Pope and this preeminent cleric of the Sunni Islamic tradition, or whether it's ones that bring in rabbis and Buddhists and, you know, Zoroastrians and all others. It fundamentally is about the supremacy of Sharia at the end of the day, is it not?
I once was able to speak to someone who had been involved in this dialogue from Providence College in Rhode Island. And they told me it was very funny. They said, well, it goes like this. It says, we tell the Muslims as Christians what a lovely and beautiful faith Islam is. And they tell us what a lovely and beautiful faith Islam is. And that's the dialogue.
That's exactly right. Andy, let me bring us to the manifestations of some of these practices, very troubling, as you've made clear, in our own country at the moment. You talked previously about the Anti-Defamation League's quiet findings on the sentiments of Muslims in the United States. But we've all been treated, if I can use that expression, to some virulently anti-Semitic comments by the two women who are now Muslim members of the United States House of Representatives, Rashida Tlaib of Michigan and Ilhan Omar of Minnesota. Give us a sense of what they're saying. First of all, is it outside of the boundaries of what you've been describing in terms of Muslim tradition, and therefore really not all that surprising, or is it par for the course?
It's very much par for the course in terms of the conspiratorial Jew hatred that you get, you know, even coming on down from on high from Al-Azhar University. And again, the idea that the Jews would even be involved in a conspiracy to kill Muhammad, when you get into the hearts of the traditions that the Quran talks about them in the fifth surah about spreading corruption twice in the 32nd verse and the 64th verse and being punished for it, by the way. So you don't have to invoke other sources, which of course exist, you know, in terms of anti-Semitism and anti-Jewish conspiracy, and they could be, you know, they could be mixing and matching from conspiratorial traditions, but they certainly have their own. So when you hear these, you know, when you hear AIPAC conspiracies or whatever Jewish influence conspiracies, you have to be, and if it's coming from a Muslim, you have to be suspicious that it's coming out of their tradition and isn't just something that they're glomming onto from other sources of conspiratorial anti-Semitism. I just think that needs to be a rule of thumb.
So give us a sense of how, obviously, as a Jew and as an authority on these matters, you took the statements about the Benjamins and the apologies and the essentially the retractions of the apologies or the doubling down, that in particular this Somali American Congresswoman Ilhan Omar has been indulging in of late.
It's sad to say this, but I think they are really, you know, marinated in this culture and also in the religious tradition. But it's very different. It was interesting to go back to an incredible speech that Ayaan Hirsi Ali had given when she accepted an award, and she's a Somali, obviously, and she was so open in 2006 when she accepted this award from the American Jewish Committee about being truly remorseful for the Quranic tradition that she was taught. And how it so permeated Somali culture to hate the Jews and to base it on the Quran, that this is the kind of, but she's such a rare person, but this is the kind of mea culpa that is really needed to rectify this situation. And again, I look to the church and to the very long and painful process, which is still ongoing in terms of Vatican II. But the church, on the other hand, has always had a mea culpa tradition, which I'm not sure Islam has. It almost as if it needs to be imposed upon it by people who, I guess, ultimately break away, like an Ayaan Hirsi Ali. But it's got to come from somewhere. And I just think that's my motivation for making this unpleasant, ugly material. It's not to bash. It's not to bash Muslims. It's just to instill some form of mea culpa that, look, if this doctrine is not aggressively challenged in some way, and it may be difficult, if not impossible, but if the process is not started, this is just going to go on forever. I mean, there were movements in this country, removing anti-Semitism from the pulpit. Well, we need, and they were actually rooted ultimately in Vatican II, but they came to outside the Catholic Church. And, we need similar movements somehow to get started to root anti-Semitism out of the mosque. But I think the only place to begin that process is to expose what it is.
Yep. Well, this is a real public service, and I know that it has earned you the attacks and criticisms of many who find in all of this Islamophobia. But if there isn't accountability for what is decidedly problematic about these practices, there is unlikely to be, as you've mentioned, Andy, any course corrections. And the thing that I think is particularly important for all of us to contemplate, you sort of alluded to this in a different context a moment ago, what we have come to know or think of, at least, as good Muslims are viewed by the authorities of the faith and those who are Sharia supremacists who tend to dominate communities outside of the Middle East, including in, this country, I'm sorry to say, they're considered bad Muslims. They're considered, even in some cases, apostates. They're people who are not following the Quranic injunctions or Muhammad's perfect model. And this is the nub of the problem. And unfortunately, it seems to me it's unlikely that people who are considered apostates, let alone people who are self-declared, former Muslims, as Ayan Hirsi Ali has become, are likely to become the sources for real reform within the community of Islam. But it's got to come from somewhere. And Andy, I think what you've been offering here is an extraordinarily important, necessary, if not sufficient, precondition. We're going to discuss at greater length with Andy Bostom the practical implications in America today of wrestling with such anti-Semitism, from whatever its provenance, but particularly that we're now seeing from elected officials in the United States Congress. So that and more with Dr. Andrew Bostom, the author of Sharia versus Freedom, The Legacy of Islamic Totalitarianism and the Legacy of Islamic Anti-Semitism, right after this.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
We're back for the fourth and final installment of our conversation with Dr. Andrew Bostom, a medical doctor by training, but an essayist of the first order in all kinds of places, including PJ Media. He's been published in the New York Post, the Washington Times, New York Daily News, National Review, and Front Page Magazine, among others. He is also the author of at least four terrific books, very much related to this subject, including The Final Solution for Israel, The Legacy of Jihad and Shiite Islamic Jew Hatred in Iran. And Andy, that brings me to a point of clarification. We've spent most of the program talking about Sunni Islam and its traditions and the aggressiveness with which its Jew hatred is expressed and practiced by not all Muslims, but enough for it to be a real problem for sure. Tell us a bit about Shiite Islam and its traditions. Its most concentrated population, of course, is in Iran, but characterize, the extent of the problem as it exists on that side of the Sunni Shiite divide.
Well, for basically 425 years until the Pahlavi Revolution in 1925, so from 1500 to 1925, Jews had a very, very dangerous and persecuted existence in Iran because of Shiite doctrine, which was at least as severe as Sunni doctrine and often more assiduously applied. But even in the modern era, the greatest Shiite intellectual of the 20th century, who has an enormous university named after him, was Tabatabai. And he wrote the definitive modern Shiite commentary on the Quran, called The Measure of Balance in the Interpretation of the Quran. And his gloss on this verse that I mentioned before in relation to current Grand Imam Al-Tayeb on Quran 582 really encapsulates everything. He talks about how the Jews, despite the fact that they could live as dhimmi, pay this humiliating poll tax, he says, yet they continued in their haughtiness, became harder in their bigotry, and turned to double dealing, breaking covenants, eagerly waiting calamities to befall the Muslims, and dealt to them the bitterest deal. And then he talks about the enmity of the Jews. Again, this is that verse, 582. The enmity of the Jews toward the divine religion, obviously Islam, and their sustained arrogance and bigotry have continued exactly in the same manner even after the Prophet. These unchanged characteristics confirm the Quran. And so this is the most authoritative modern Muslim intellectual. He was called a theosopher, a combination philosopher and theologian. And again, it just shows you how mainstream it was. And he was, he's not a Khomeini or a Khamenei or a Nasrallah, etc. This is the leading religious teacher of his generation. He died in the early 1980s, and this is the standard commentary. It gives you a sense of the depth of this kind of theology.
So when the Iranians chant endlessly, "Death to Israel," they have their Quranic foundation for doing so, as well as the teachings of their mullahs. Very, very ominous indeed. Andrew Bassam, let me just finally ask about, what do we do about this? It's not enough, obviously, to hope for a reformation within Islam or even to encourage it. But what should we be doing with respect to, visible, aggressive, serial anti-Semitic statements like those that Ilhan Omar has been issuing from various congressional and social media platforms? There's talk within the Congress that she should be removed from her seat on the House Foreign Affairs Committee. Do you have any thoughts as to whether that's an appropriate response given what she's been doing?
I'm admittedly ambivalent about it. I think on the one hand, keeping her there, I know she does have certain security clearances, which could be potentially at issue. But keeping her there does illustrate the problem, and at least till now, the fecklessness, if not the complicity of the Democratic Party in dealing with her and the larger issue that she represents. On the other hand, if she can adversely affect our security interests, then that would be a consideration, obviously, for removing her.
Yeah, well, this is a real concern. I have to say, we've got in our friend Trevor Loudon's work much evidence that members of Congress who do not have to undergo a security clearance exercise, the process, the evaluation, the background checks, and so on, are now getting access. It's not just Ilhan Omar, it's lots of them. I think Trevor estimates it's 125 of those in the United States Senate and House of Representatives are, tied to the socialists or communists or Muslim Brotherhood or in some other way. Very, very dubious in terms of their reliability with respect to very sensitive and classified information. But, what I'm struck by, and is that, of course, Steve King, Republican from Iowa, was stripped of his committee assignments for making statements that in the great scheme of things, especially given his explanation that what he's attributed to him was not what he said, seemed to be considerably less problematic than what we're seeing now repeatedly from Ms. Omar. And as you've indicated, the Democratic caucus has scarcely been able to mount a complaint, let alone a demand for her, you know, to cease and desist, to say nothing of removing her from the House Foreign Affairs Committee or other committee assignments. This seems to be a very substantial double standard at work here.
Right. So, so again, the question becomes, is just illustrating that double standard until the Democrats will do something about it useful relative to the sort of acute security risk, you know, she might pose. But in terms of the larger questions, I think her case, Tlaib's case, they raise fundamental questions. I don't think there's enough discussion from my perspective about the extent of the phenomenon, you know, the data that I was citing earlier about how literally across the world now, wherever you look, the rates of this, of what the ADL, the Anti-Defamation League, classifies as really kind of extreme Jew hatred, are consistently 2 to 3-fold higher in Muslim populations. Just I think those data themselves need to be discussed at the congressional level and think tanks, et cetera. And then, of course, that in turn leads into the question of why. And my conclusion after studying this for almost 20 years now is that you've got to go back to the textual basis of it, to the teaching, to the religious teaching, to the doctrines, at least to understand by and large where it's coming from. And then the question is, well, for heaven's sake, what do you actually do about that? I mean, we do have examples, historical examples, in terms of dealing with the anti-Semitic tradition in Christianity, and it was dealt with very forthrightly.
Finally, after a long, long time when it was not.
Exactly. And it's an ongoing process. But my fear is that, look, Christianity has always had a mea culpa strain. I'm not terribly aware of that innately within Islam, which to me, at least thinking about it with some logic, means that if anything, you'd have to expose the condition more aggressively in dealing with Islam, because it doesn't seem to innately want to come to those kinds of negative conclusions.
Certainly, it seems extremely unlikely, Andy Bostom, if there is a Quranic grounding for the behavior. This is the problem that I think not only those of us who are quite concerned about Sharia and its supremacist tendencies must be concerned and troubled by, but it should be very troubling to an awful lot of Muslims as well. Dr. Andrew Bostom, we are at the end of our hour with you. Thank you very much for your time today, as well as the extraordinary service you've rendered over decades of documenting, explaining, and helping call attention to this very significant problem, one that seems to be becoming more so by the day. Thank you, Andy. We look forward to talking with you again. We look forward to talking to the rest of you again tomorrow. Same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.